This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are hosted by Anton Angelo and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio. Tonight at 7 o'clock, a podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz. And welcome to the show. Tonight we're joined by regular panellists, Professor Samuel Mann from Otago Polytechnic, and the show is hosted by me, Shane Gallagher. Welcome to the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
And tonight our guest is Denise Roach, and she's a Green MP, and it's her first time in Parliament this last election. And she's from Helensville originally. And she currently lives in Waiheke Island in Auckland Central, which is an amazing little community that lives off the. It's an island that sits in the bay in Auckland?
In the Hauraki Gulf.
In the Hauraki Gulf. Okay. And so how do you get to and from Waiheke Island when you're going to work?
Very sustainable public transport. So this morning's journey took me by bus to the ferry terminal, then by ferry into downtown Auckland, bus out to the airport, and then flew down to Dunedin.
Fantastic. And you're, of course, the Green Party spokesperson on industrial relations, community and voluntary sector, community economic development, waste, gambling, Auckland, and state services. None of those sound very like kind of, you know, what somebody from outside the environmental movement would imagine to be kind of a green issues. So how do you answer, and I often get asked that question myself, you know, why does the Green Party get involved in economics? Why does it get involved in things like gambling? How do you answer those questions when they're put to you?
Well, the Green Party is founded on four principles plus the overarching principle of the Treaty of Waitangi. But those four principles are democratic decision-making, peace and justice, and that's where this comes in, environmental and ecological wisdom, and
non-violence.
And non-violence, thank you. Took me a while. And we maintain that you can't have a good economy if you can't have a good environment, that one doesn't play off against the other. And part of the economy is our people. So social justice is our founding principle for the Greens. And that's where a lot of my portfolios sit. They sit within that social justice arena. It's like that old thing that, you know, you can't have people believing in God, and you can't preach to them and convert them as a missionary until you've filled their bellies. And it's the same thing here. We need to ensure that our people are cared for so that they can care for the environment.
So you were at the Service and Food Workers Union National Conference here?
Yes.
And that's why you're down here in Dunedin. And what kind of issues are those workers facing, and what was your contribution as a Green MP to the conference?
Well, the Green Party has signed up to support the Living Wage campaign, and that's a campaign that the Service and Food Workers Union has kicked off. They've got over 120 different community organisations and faith-based organisations working with them to challenge the government and local councils and employers to pay a living wage. And what it means is that they're asking that employers sign up to pay well above the minimum wage, and a lot of service and food workers unions members are on that low minimum wage of $13.50 an hour. In fact, there's 300,000 workers employed on that right now. They're being subsidised by the in-work tax credit, which means that taxpayers are basically subsidising employers to keep wages low. And we don't think it's good for the economy if we have low-paid workers, because they are they're not only being supported by us as taxpayers, but they're not actually contributing as much as they can to our communities. They're not participating. They're working too hard to look after their families. They're working too hard to participate fully in civic society. So that was one of the things that I was there for. I did actually mention my waste portfolio as well. And the delegates are actually surprisingly keen on a lot of issues around waste as well.
And so your waste portfolio, that's a bit of a passion for you. And
yeah.
Is that... Why does waste become a passion for someone? I mean, it's smelly, it's gross, everyone wants to put it in a boot bin and throw it away. Why is it a passion for you?
It ties in with quite a few of my portfolios, actually. If you give me a minute, I'll explain it. I've got industrial relations, so that is about workers' rights, if you like. I've also got state services, and the state service sector is actually under a lot of pressure at the moment. There's been over 5,000 jobs lost over the last 4 years. When those services are cut, the community and voluntary sector, which is another one of my portfolios, tends to pick up a lot of the services that the government is pulling back from, and they do it, and they're underfunded. And that's where the gambling portfolio kicks in, if you like. A lot of community organisations rely very heavily on pokey money. And pokey money, whether it's in casinos or whether it's in pubs and clubs, 40% of that money comes from people who have problems. They can't exist and they can't make a profit from pokey gambling unless there is problem gambling. But that money is going back into the community and voluntary sector. Waste, on the other hand, is about community economic development. There's jobs in rubbish. There's huge jobs in rubbish. And in the community recycling sector, it's been a real success story of creating jobs and with a really solid environmental outcome and social outcomes in small communities where the community sector has picked up that rubbish, if you like, and picked up the recycling processes as well, and created some really good success stories like Seabeck and Kaitaia, where they now employ 70 people. That's in a community of 20,000 people. If you can replicate that across the country, you're looking at really good, solid jobs and communities growing together and growing strong and healthy and environmentally sound. The other thing with waste that I get really excited about is the potential for community organisations to make some money out of rubbish. And one of the things that I'm looking at within my portfolio is the potential of legislating for what they call extended producer responsibility. And that is refunds on drink containers. You know, in the old days, you used to get rugby clubs and they'd do a bottle drive and they'd pick up all the bottles in the neighbourhood and they'd make money from that. And we've lost the ability to get refunds on drink containers, but it's a very successful way of community funding and community connection as well in places like South Australia and all through Europe as well. I think the Scouts in South Australia make over $1 million a year just from refunds on drink containers, collecting those containers. And it's really good for in terms of reducing litter. It creates jobs, and it's great for the environment. Most people who are producing products from recycled material really like it as well, because the quality of recycling that they get is really high. So there shouldn't be a lot of negative thoughts about it, but actually we've had massive pushback from some of the major beverage companies who don't like regulation at all.
Why don't they like you giving them back the bottles? Because surely bottling is quite an expensive and activity. You create the bottles, you put labels on them, you fill them with drinks, ship them out. Surely that's a resource that's worth reusing. Why is there a pushback from industry?
Basically, it's about who has control of the waste stream, who has control of the products. And what we have in New Zealand is we have one-use beverage containers. And so, you know, we go, great, here's an aluminium tin, here's a bottle, we drink what's in it. Often the beverage container costs more than the actual stuff that goes inside it. And then we've trained ourselves over a period of about 20 years to say, oh, well, it's gone now. That container is gone. We used to have refillable milk bottles. We used to have refillable pop bottles, you know. And that's why the refunds worked so well in New Zealand. But as companies got bigger and more centralised, the one use was quite useful for them because basically they didn't have to deal with it at the end of its life, that container. And in fact, a whole industry has been set up dealing with those containers. You know, you now have councils who have collection systems, which are worth millions. So that's a company that's got a contract to do that. That product or that container is trucked all around the place until it's sorted. That may be another business. It may be a mechanized system. That product or container is then baled, and often it's shipped overseas, so it becomes part of an international commodity market. And that's another set of businesses involved as well. The carbon footprint for one container is quite amazing. So if you stop it halfway through and say, right, we're going to make this a resource that everybody can get, we're going to say this is worth money to everyone, then you start to interfere with those chains and those businesses, and that's why you get pushback. Waste is worth money. It's just a lot of people who have lost control of it.
So how far away are we from actually having legislation on extended producer responsibility?
Well, the Waste Minimisation Act, which is actually a Green Party piece of legislation that was first, I think it was pulled out of the ballot in about 2005. Initially, we had container deposit legislation as part of that, but it was pulled because it was seen as there would be too much pushback, and it was strategically, it was important that we get our first Waste Minimisation Act in place, and we did get that in finally in 2008. So it's there, it's in our policies, it's now just a matter of getting it picked up by the government. I don't think this government will do it. Industry certainly is, as I've said, the beverage industry quite opposed to it. The Glass Packaging Council seem to be fairly hesitant about it, which is surprising, and same with the plastics industry as well, the Packaging Council of New Zealand. So it's a matter of trying to sway those industry players over in order for them to say that it's a good idea to sway the government. The alternative is that I put it up as a private member's bill. It won't get through this time, and it's actually a gamble putting a private member's bill up. But it's a concept that actually captures people's imagination, so there's the potential to run a really good campaign around it and get massive community support for it.
I was going to say, could we as individuals or communities simply say no to waste when we buy a television or appliance, when we say, no, actually we don't want the cardboard box and the polystyrene, we want the television, thank you?
Yeah, we could do that, but actually one of the bigger problems is the TV at the end of its life, and, you know, they're rolling out the TV take-back scheme at the moment. It's the one of two product stewardship schemes that the Ministry for the Environment are looking at. The other one is tyres. And the whole process for dismantling a TV is another huge chain of businesses and industries as well. The producers of TVs aren't even thinking about that. Where I think we could be making some inroads in the current environment is to say we should have advanced disposal fees on a lot of these hard to get rid of products like tyres, like computers, and like TVs as well. There is the ability, I think, for as a consumer to say, no, I don't want this packaging. And in fact, there have been really successful community consumer campaigns to get rid of plastic bags in places like Nelson, for example. And I've seen it done as a protest in supermarkets to rip the packaging off. Wanaka Wastebusters have an amazing thing called the Unpack It Awards every year. You've heard of it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Where they get the best and the worst packaging. And people vote on them. And this is one way of highlighting consumer behaviour. And I think, you know, really, at the end of the day, we look for what are essentially transport solutions to waste when really waste is a behaviour problem. We spend so much money on collections and picking things up and taking them places and reprocessing them when really we should be looking at the top of the waste hierarchy at how to avoid it in the first place.
Well, we'd need to go even beyond what you were talking about and address built-in obsolescence. And
yeah, cradle-to-cradle product stewardship is where we need to be heading. We're starting to see it in polytechs and universities and design schools, but there's still far too much obsolescence built in. And this whole idea from producers that it's somebody else's problem, well, in actual fact, it becomes all of our problem.
And an economy that's based on buying more stuff.
That's right.
Selling more stuff.
Yeah. And we can't. We just can't continue to grow by using our finite resources, because most of the waste that we are producing comes from resources that we've basically mined, either oil or a lot of the precious minerals in TVs and electronic equipment. All that is rare earth stuff. They're starting to talk about urban mining now. So the extraction industry will be how to get the good stuff out of the landfills.
And has this been attempted in other countries? I remember a couple of years ago the EU was talking about introducing these kind of fees and structures. Has this been implemented anywhere in the world yet? Or
yeah, so we're not really that far ahead in terms of waste. And it's not surprising when you get the operations director from the Ministry for the Environment, as he did last week at the Wastemen's Conference in Hamilton, opened the keynote speech by saying waste isn't a problem in New Zealand because we've got lots of room for landfill. And I have to say, every landfill operator in the room, and there were many there, all started to perk up remarkably, as you can imagine. So we haven't really come very far at all, but in places in Scandinavia and Europe, not so much the UK, but certainly in those European countries, there's a more of a focus on recovering the best value from recyclable products. They're looking at moving towards multiple use plastics as well, so refilling plastic bottles, and they're also looking at alternatives. A lot of alternative packaging. Germany, for example, if you're exporting stuff from New Zealand to Germany, you have to actually have a plan of what to do with the packaging stuff that you've exported there. You have to take it back. And the EU has been very good at directing a whole bunch of requirements to other countries. A lot of them aren't actually meeting the targets, but they're getting there. One of the ways many countries, like in Denmark, for example, one of the ways they're achieving a much lower rate of waste to landfill is they've put huge levies on waste. In New Zealand, when we got the Waste Minimisation Act in, for the first time we introduced a levy, but it's actually only set at $10 per tonne. So it's not a lot. But that $10 per tonne is actually funding a whole bunch of activities around waste minimisation, and half of that money goes back to councils for further waste minimisation activities.
One of the things I talked about on the show last year was after a trip to Waiheke Island, I was very impressed with the fact that the rubbish was sitting in bags on the wharf waiting to get taken off on the ferry. And I wrote a blog post about that, and loads of people from Waiheke said, hang on, that's great, but it's about to stop. because it's being shipped off to Hamilton or somewhere. Now, you were actively involved in the waste process on Waiheke. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So for 7 years, I worked for the Waste Resource Trust, which is why I've got the waste portfolio for the Greens. And in fact, I had my own radio show called Talking Rubbish. And as you can tell, I can just go on about it. Yeah, well, so what we had was we had a community organisation that was contracted to the council to collect the waste and the recycling. We had lost our recycling in the 80s when the council, Waiheke County Council, had merged with to become Auckland City Council. And so the community had said, right, we're going to take it back. We didn't have a landfill, so all our waste had to be shipped off the island. And the cost of that was $200 per tonne. And that was being paid for directly out of our rate. So there was a huge incentive to reduce the amount of waste that we were sending across to the mainland. So we set up our recycling processes and we got people to separate their recycling into shopping bags for collection so that most of the work was done for the collectors. And then it was hand-sorted, baled by hand, and sold at a very high price to mostly New Zealand reprocessors. That basically was a $500,000 operation created. No, it was actually in excess of that. It was a $1.2 million operation. It provided something like $600,000 worth of money into our local economy through jobs and, local people fixing the machinery. We won awards for our reprocessing of glass products, our glass crusher. And we had one of the highest diversion rates in Auckland. But no good deed goes unpunished, I guess. We were, when I was the Auckland City Councillor, I had a clear conflict of interest because of my previous involvement with the Waste Resource Trust and also the fact that my partner was one of the directors of the trust. We lost the contract to a multinational organisation who brought in wheelie bins, which means that all that sorting that had happened in people's homes and all that education that I'd done for 7 years went out the window into a commingled wheelie bin, which was then compacted, freighted across to Auckland, sorted by a mechanical system, and most of the stuff sent to overseas offshore reprocessors. But they came in. They're a multinational company. They came in, about $500,000 below what the community organisation had tendered. So we lost it. And we lost 13 jobs in the process.
So how did that happen? I mean, similar things happened here with Wanaka Waste Busters and Queenstown District Council awarded again the waste management contract to an international company based in Auckland. And, threatening the jobs of the Wanaka Waste Buster community organisation. How do councillors who are supposed to be looking after the interests of the people of their district justify or make up in their heads that they can, get rid of jobs, get rid of a community-based organisation, get rid of all that social capital and local resilience? How do they make those decisions? How do they justify them?
Well, from my experience as a former Auckland City Councillor, it was looking purely at the bottom line. So rather than looking at the environmental outcomes, the social outcomes, as well as the economic outcomes and the cultural outcomes, they look purely at the economic outcomes. But even that economic assessment of the contracts, even when the multinationals are coming in with a much lower bid, doesn't take into account the reduction in costs that come from some of the social elements of the community organisation. So, for example, Innovative Waste Kaikoura, they did an assessment of how much money their council saved by them employing all the at-risk youth to work on the Trees for Travellers program that they set up, and how much savings they'd made in terms of reduced graffiti, reduced crime, reduced dope sales, all those sorts of reductions in social problems. They put a monetary value on it, and it came out as just as good as an international competitor. But those things are often not seen as a primary reason during the procurement process. And there's been quite a lot of work done to quantify how much that money that would come to. But councils and councillors particularly are often looking at the latest, you know, quickest, fastest, cheapest way to provide a service. And I have to say that in the case of Trans-Pacific and probably Smart as well for Wanaka, they were really, really pitched to. They were really, really wooed. The contracts were quite low.
So this is despite the councils having the four well-beings that they're responsible for.
Mm.
And I know this isn't your portfolio, but I'll ask you anyway. Those four well-beings are looking like they're going to be removed.
That's certainly part of the local government reforms that the government has flagged. Right up until February this year, I was a local government person.
That.
You can, yeah. And the reason I've got Auckland issues as part of my portfolios is so that our local government spokesperson is Eugenie Sage. But anything to do with Auckland, we work together on it just because of that experience that I'd had.
So given that they're not doing it now, and they do have that four well-beings responsibility, what chance is there for the future of them looking wider than just the monetary?
Well, most councils are actually opposing the removal of the four well-beings, and with good reason, because it's not just in terms of their procurement around things like waste contracts, but it's also in terms of what other services they can provide, including things like centre parades or events or, pensioner housing. A whole bunch of those things basically go down the tubes when you remove those four well-beings. We argued very strongly during the Waiheke waste contracting issue that it would be contrary to the four well-beings to give the contract to Trans-Pacific, but we didn't win that argument because of it was a political decision in the end, and we didn't have the numbers.
You're growing olives on Waiheke. Are you still growing olives on Waiheke?
Yes, we are. I'm part of a cooperative. We grow wine as well. Yeah, I hate olive picking. I really do.
I don't like the little rakes.
We've got the little rakes. They're the thing with picking grapes is that you can eat them, and actually I like drinking the wine, but I can't stand olive oil. So it's always there in the back of my head as I'm scraping these things out of the trees. Yeah.
My parents grew olives near Wanaka, and the picking was done in very, very cold conditions. I think you should have carry on picking them in Waiheke, because it would be much more pleasant. Now, this afternoon I read your maiden speech. I enjoyed it very much.
Oh, thank you.
And I'd just like to read you some of it back, and I'd just like to... you say that you come from a hotbed of activism. Now, we've asked quite a lot of guests on the show whether or not they consider themselves activists, and we have some quite different responses to that. So, do you consider yourself an activist?
Yes, definitely.
You've always been an activist?
Yep. You've obviously done your homework. So I was about 21 when I started out as a union organiser. And I think it was probably the 1981 Springbok tour that galvanised me into political activism. And, my desire to change the world obviously hasn't faded at all. That's why I'm an MP.
Do you get, as an MP, do you get to do the things you want to do?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a lot more fun than being a local body politician, basically because it's a lot better resourced with people and, with people and the parliamentary library, you can kind of find stuff out. In opposition, what our job is to come up with some really good solutions. You know, what is the vision that we want to see for New Zealand? How would we get there? And then try and convince the other political parties to do it. Part of it is also to highlight what's being done wrong. And so that's where you see a lot of the mudslinging. And I think I described it today at the Service and Food Workers Union conference that it's kind of like just finding the mucky bits and then throwing mud.
Do you enjoy question time?
No, I don't. It can be quite weird. It's theatre. People don't act like that normally. The real business, the absolute real business, is what happens in select committee. That's when you actually really see how people operate. And you see how not just the heads of the party, so you never see the ministers there unless they're fronting up to respond to something. But you see how the rest of the party operate and how they treat their members of parliament. So it's quite interesting.
Yeah, my son, when he was first, a couple of years ago, when he was about 10, and he was watching parliament, I was watching a speech, and he came in and he was wondering what I was doing, and I was looking at that, and he was horrified by the way the MPs behaved. And I assured him that the Green MPs did not behave, they behaved well. And,
we try really hard to.
But that he was horrified. I mean, so he said, well, we wouldn't be allowed to talk like that at school. Why do adults behave like that? And what is the culture in the parliament that allows people to, I mean, act like yobs?
Yeah. I'm not sure where this comes from, and it's kind of bugged me since I've been there. I find it really unpleasant because it's just point scoring, and it is theatre. It's theatre for the media, and it's an excuse for bad behaviour. It's not just during media, during question time as well. Often during speeches and quite heated speeches, there'll be a lot of heckling and harassment going on, some of it quite unpleasant. I think there was some media coverage about Maggie Barry barracking Jacinda Ardern during the paid parental leave debate. Well, basically, Maggie said that Jacinda wasn't qualified to speak on this issue because she didn't have children. I mean, I was really pleased that that was picked up by the media, but that happens all the time. Some of it can get very, very personal and unpleasant. We try really hard not to engage in that. It's really hard sometimes when you're being targeted when you're speaking. What I found out is that if you're on your feet speaking, if someone interjects and you acknowledge that interjection, then that interjection actually goes into Hansard, so it's recorded. If you don't acknowledge it, then the interjection is not recorded. So part of the game, if you like, is to try and get your interjection into the history books. And so I think that's part of the reason why it happens. But most of the time it's just bad manners and unpleasant and doesn't add anything to governing the country.
You've talked about your wide range of portfolios and you're obviously seeing them as some sort of integrated system. But there's an awful lot of other stuff that you have to get your head around. Are you swamped?
Yeah, I do find myself a bit swamped at the moment. We're nearly a year into our first term, so it's third of the way there, and I just feel like I'm gaining fluency, if you like, in a whole bunch of those areas. Some of the hardest things for me have been to learn the rules of the House. You know, when the speaker goes, order, order. You're supposed to know the standing orders, and it's like, it's not one of my strong points, but I'm getting there.
What was the number one thing that you've learnt in that year?
Number one thing that I've learnt? Oh, I've learnt that the best thing you can do as an MP is to listen. And I think that's probably one of the hardest things as well for an MP, because as you get busier and more swamped, it's harder to listen. But in order to be an effective advocate, you need to be very well connected to the constituents that you represent. And the way we work it within the Green Party, because we're all list MPs, our constituents are basically the stakeholders, not only our members, but also the stakeholders who are active in our portfolio areas. So the biggest thing for me has been to maintain those connections and to listen and take advice. There's no point in being a representative if you can't represent anyone.
Do you think it's harder being a list MP?
No, actually, I think it's probably easier because I was a politician with my own set of constituents, both as an Auckland City Councillor for the Hauraki Gulf within my own community, and after the last local body elections, I was a local board member as well. And that was way more personal and often very frustrating in your ability to get things done. So it's not quite so personal. And certainly there's less personal attacks apart from in the House, and most of the time that's just rubbish anyway.
You said in your maiden speech that the biggest threat we face is disengaged citizens.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there are a million people didn't vote last year, last time. And worryingly, a lot of those people who didn't vote, it was their second or third time of not voting. And research shows that if you vote once when you're young the first time, you will continue to be a voter. You might get disillusioned and forget, but you are likely to participate in civil society. But when you get, a quarter of our population saying, no, we're not participating, then you need to start worrying about why. One of the things that I've heard through the Living Wage campaign is that a lot of people are actually too busy and too disengaged from a lot of civic society to participate fully because they're low paid and they're working too hard. So you might have somebody earning $13.50 an hour, working three jobs. They don't have time to coach their kids' soccer. They don't have time to take an interest in a whole bunch of things that affect them personally. That is the result of the politics of the day, and they may become disenchanted and disengaged as well.
But you distinguish that from voter apathy.
Yep, I don't think we should call it voter apathy because I think I said in my maiden speech that that's blaming the victim. I think politicians and Parliament have got a lot to learn and a lot to do to be more responsive to voters, and we need to make it. We need to have voters understanding that what they do affects the future for not only them but for the whole country. And I don't think we've done that. We've kind of removed politicians from the people.
You've said that one of the things that drives you is injustice.
Yep.
When did you first notice injustice?
I think I probably noticed injustice when I was very young. I think I also said in my speech that I'm one of nine children. I'm the eighth out of nine. you kind of notice when the big kids get a better deal than the little kids, So within that setting, I think I noticed quite a lot. But I remember very vividly campaigning to join the cricket team. So becoming a feminist, if you like, when I was 10. Because I was told I wasn't allowed to join the cricket team because I was a girl. And I did join the cricket team in the end.
This week there's been talk about the Secretary of Education talking about injustice in schools, and the teachers have responded to that saying, hey, I think we're doing a good job, and I've forgotten the woman's name, has said no. It is world class in terms of the average, but it's not spread across every child. Therefore, it can't be world class. Why should we care about every kid?
We should care about every kid because our kids are precious, and I'll explain why. Not just, you know, because, you know, I love my kid, you love your kid sort of thing. But I listened to a demographer, Dr. Natalie Jackson, from Waikato University Population Studies last week, talk about the fact that the dropping birth rate means that our children are becoming increasingly precious, and so their education is crucial if we want to sustain our standard of living as our population ages. If we refuse or don't look after the ones who are tailing behind now, by the time they're in their 20s, 30s, 40s and supporting the rest of us who are aging, then the standard of living is going to be so much worse. They're not going to be capable of supporting us. We've got a situation where our young people now are being recruited from other countries because of their knowledge and expertise, and we're not investing in the children and young people coming behind them. The expert advisory panel on children recommended that we address child poverty and we give all our kids the best possible start in life by introducing a universal child benefit for at least the first 6 years of life, and then it tapering off as they get older. Which strikes me as probably the most sensible thing that we can be doing. And as well as that, we need to be making sure that our kids are achieving, because these are the ones that are going to be supporting the rest of the country as we age. And they are becoming precious.
We interviewed a couple of weeks ago Nicola Atwell from the various places, including the Children's Issues Centre, and in when we were talking to her, the statistic came up that in response to a question of should there be systems to protect children or words to that effect, something like 50-something percent, Shane might remember, mm-hmm. Said, no, there shouldn't. And we looked at that, and some people clearly think that raising children is a very individual, parents' responsible thing the state should keep out. Where do you think the line fits in the sort of the community responsibility?
Definitely. Yeah, you choose to have children, you should be raising them. Some people need more help than others. Universal benefits work. So the idea that the government has of targeting people, and generally it sounds fairly punitive. You know, when they say targeting, I see basically a target and some pretty, you know, vicious sticks and carrots, and not any carrots that they're using. But what we know is that universal benefits work. They work for ensuring that we have a very good standard of living for our over 65s. Now, we have universal benefits for pensioners. Doesn't matter if you're a billionaire, you still are eligible for national superannuation. We should be offering that same thing to our kids. Yes, parents have the responsibility to raise the children, but we all have a responsibility, every single one of us, for all of us to support our kids into a better future. Oh, sounded like a slogan, sorry.
Okay, I'm still reading your maiden speech here. You say that your children are destined to inherit an environment much more degraded than the country that you grew up in.
Mm.
Which country? Sorry, where did you grow up? You grew up in Auckland?
Waikato.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was it, I was going to say land of milk and honey, but it's the milk was causing the trouble. Was it a land of milk and honey?
We had access to bush, we had access to sea. We swam in the Waipa River, we went eeling, we caught eels in the Waikato River, we, gathered watercress. I looked at the Waipa River quite recently because I was at something in Ngāruawhia and just went, no, you wouldn't swim there now. You really wouldn't. Driving through the Waikato out to Raglan a couple of weeks ago and just seeing, you know, just streams that have not, where the cattle can get into it, where, you know, brown streams with no kind of, no awareness, I guess, that these are resources that need to be looked after. That's certainly what it felt like to me. But because there was a lower population, maybe, and we had a higher standard of living then, and, you know, my parents, Dad worked on the railway, so we weren't rich by any means, but we had access to a whole lot of stuff that I don't think kids get access to now.
Our wages, all of our wages, in fact, can probably be attributed to milk prices.
Yeah, they probably...
Is that a sacrifice we have to make?
Well, I mean, I heard a really good speech by Rod Oram quite recently, who said, you know, the government's economic policy and the way to get out of, you know, the recession that we've been in, the government's policy is that we grow. And they've actually said that the dairy industry has to grow by 4%, but you can't physically do that. You've actually got to get smarter about the products, and I think we need to get smarter about the products. If we're losing our land, which we are, to offshore interests because they're planning for the future, they're saying that there's a need to feed their population, and it's fairly cheap to produce milk and milk products here. We're not thinking like that. We're not thinking about the higher value export products. We're just thinking about, you know, cows, dairy, you know, irrigate some more land in the Mackenzie Basin, put some more cows on it. And doing the same thing is not, over and over and over, is not going to get us out of the recession.
Are we at hard resource limits?
Yeah, I think we are. We're, you know, peak oil. What we're seeing with the circling of the sharks, which is the offshore oil companies wanting to drill and test for oil in our waters and some of the deepest waters in the world, what we're seeing is that that drive for scarcer resources. Basically, there is oil there, it's just harder to get, so it will become more expensive, which means it will be priced out of our range over time.
What is the Greens' policy on growth?
We should ask Russell this rather than me, because he's the good guy on this stuff. You can't sustain growth at the expense of the environment. We can create a good standard of living, but we have to live within our means. And we can create good jobs, and they have to be high earning jobs. There's no point in creating and continuing to create a low wage economy, because it doesn't. It feeds that gap between the rich and the poor. So we need to be looking at improving the lot for all of us. And that means improving those at the bottom of the pile first, really.
You talked somewhere about greed being one of our main problems. Surely me doing well for myself and wanting to do well for myself, is that greed?
No. No, it's not.
So when does it start becoming greed?
Starts becoming greed when you're trading in the misery of others. And if you look at the pokie industry, for example... You know, 40% of the profits. Well, yeah, 40% of the profits, and we're talking, you know, what, 800 million or so a year come from people who've got a serious problem, and who benefits from that? You know, the fact that a lot of that money goes back to the community from the pubs and club pokies, you sanitises what is actually a harmful way of gathering money.
What do you want to achieve in the next 2 years?
Oh. I think there's some wins that we can get in the community and voluntary sector. I think we could be convincing the government to look at a better way of better definition of charitable purpose. I think there are some things that we can be doing to minimise harm around gambling, and Te Ororoa Flavel's got a bill up that I'm supporting, and we're hearing submissions on that. And I think in the waste sector we can get some real good change and some real simple change just by invoking some of the regulations around product stewardship for tyres, advanced disposal fees for tyres, advanced disposal fees for some of the other priority products that come through. But we actually have to declare some. And I'd also like to see the waste levy put up so that it does act as a disincentive. So those are some things that I think are achievable within this too.
Who in the government are you enjoying working with? Who can you talk to a bit sensibly about things?
You're struggling here, aren't you? I can see this in your face.
Well, surprisingly, Jonathan Young, who's the chair of the Commerce Committee, and he's been the chair of that committee while we've been listening to the gambling harm reduction bill. And he's very measured, and he's very polite, and I enjoy him a lot. The other one is Mark Mitchell, who's also quite a surprisingly thoughtful person. Yeah, so it's quite interesting to get to know these people outside of the parliamentary, that arena, and to find out what they're really like and how they interact with people.
What do we have to do to actually get, not just them, but the wider government to listen and to stop thinking that the sustainable message is hippies talking on some tree-hugging fairy tale?
I think probably the best message we can give them is that the next general election, vote Green, of course. But I think also submitting on bills, submitting against a lot of the changes that they're trying to ring through to the Local Government Act, to the Resource Management Act, to all these things that they're pushing through for people power to fight back. It's one of the reasons why the petition for the calling for a referendum on the sale of state-owned assets is a really good tool. It's to say to the government, look, you don't have a mandate to sell our state assets. We need to keep them, and we need to have a referendum about it. It's not a binding referendum, but it certainly is a tool to slow down the government's agenda. So I believe in people power. That's part of my activist background.
Lastly, I've lost it. Lastly, no, it's just really disappeared. You say that we need to clean up the mess that we've been creating.
Yes.
What do you see as the, instead of cleaning up the mess sounds negative, what do you see as the better future? The mess cleaned up better future. What would you like to see happen?
Well, I think we've got a huge amount of work that we could be doing and jobs that we could be creating and doing things like planting up our waterways. The take-up rate for that is really, really low because farmers have to pay for it themselves and they're not prepared to bite into their bottom line. But we could be creating an enormous amount of cleaner streams and waterways by doing that. There's things that we can be doing around our imports and our exports and our production, our waste streams. There's a lot more that we can be doing to harvest the benefits out of that. I'm worried about going into too much detail because I'll just start rabbiting on about waste again, talking rubbish. But there are so many things that we could be doing to clean up the mess, and we've got to be looking after our people, because if we don't look after our people, there's no point.
Okay, one last question then: is it a fun job?
Oh yeah, it's great. It's the most fun I've had in years. It's a huge privilege, and there's only 121 MPs in the country, so it's That's quite amazing to think that. But finding stuff out and then attempting to change the world and to be in a place where you can, you could have a go, that's amazing and a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for tonight. This was the show for the 1st of November. Our guest was MP Denise Roach from the Green Party. Our panellist was Professor Samuel Mann. And your host was me, Shane Gallagher. You can get podcasts of previous shows at sustainablelens.org, or and you can subscribe on iTunes as well. We are number 2 in the world. I would like to boast. We would like to boast about that. We're number 2 in the if you look at iTunes. And thank you for our show. We hope you enjoyed it.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.